Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this first hour of the program, our guest is Rick Kaplan. He is the former president of CNN US. He joins us every once in a while when he's visiting town here as a member of the faculty of the Journalism School here at the University of Illinois. He's also a full-time professor at Harvard University, where he teaches journalism. He previously has held a number of very high-level positions at ABC Television, most recently as executive producer of special projects at the ABC Television Network. Before that, he served as executive producer for World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, as executive producer for Primetime Live, and as executive producer for Nightline. Rick Kaplan has been involved in producing so many programs in television, it would be quite lengthy to list them all. But we'll mention that he has won 34 Emmy Awards, 4 Overseas Press Club Awards, 3 George Foster Peabody Awards, and that list goes on as well. Since leaving CNN last year, as I mentioned, he accepted a professorship in journalism at Harvard University, and he's also a member of the journalism faculty here at the University of Illinois. He is in town to teach some classes here, and he'll also be giving a brown bag lecture this noon on the topic of mega mergers in the media industry. That's 12 noon today in room 213 of Gregory Hall.
No, 123, isn't
123?
It?
123? Well,
I don't know. Maybe they changed my schedule.
Says here
213 of Gregory Hall. You're right.
Okay.
I would have gone to the wrong place.
Okay. Well, glad we got that straight then.
That doesn't help to go to Harvard, right?
Well, in some ways, I'm sure it does. Anyway, we're glad to have you with us, and also glad to have participants in the conversation. If people would like to call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, any questions? We're going to talk about the news business, but anything that you'd like to throw into the mix, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, anywhere you are in Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I always try to do it. You know, I come every semester. I do a week of classes at the School of Communications, the Journalism School of the School of Communications here. And, you know, the kids this semester are quite remarkable. I mean, they're remarkable every semester, but this has been fun. I've only started for a day, but the kids are great.
Well, the journalism school is really on the upswing.
They've
got some remarkable faculty. Leon Dash is now teaching here.
Ron Yates is the chair, and he's an extraordinary journalist. And it's a great school. They got a great dean in Kim Rotzel, and they've been growing leaps and bounds over the past 5 years.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let me ask you, now that you're out of the day-to-day news business and television, do you watch a lot of TV news and do you like what you see?
It's funny. I don't watch a lot of TV news now because my teaching stint at Harvard takes a lot of time. And I also am offered the opportunity there to go to a lot of seminars and meetings and lectures that I normally probably would have skipped, but it's a real opportunity to hear about the situation in Russia or China or Japan or to educate yourself, I mean, to open your own mind. I've probably done more thinking about journalism in the last 6 months than I did in maybe 30 years prior. I do watch a little bit. I watched election night, and it was a little frustrating, very frustrating.
Yeah.
Well, it's the first election I'd missed working in since 1968, really. And, I was kind of sitting there. I understood why the first call was made. I was very surprised when the first call was made because I thought that there were panhandle polls open in Florida, and it had always been my policy never to make a call when any poll is open. That was an issue all the time in Indiana where they had where the timeline splits the state.
Yeah.
But they made the call, and then when I heard them take the call back, I thought, well, now don't make any more calls because the other policy that most of us followed, and it's interesting, a lot of the people producing the shows on the various networks had never done it before. So this was a real test by fire, and they got burned. But when you have a state where the numbers start to skew or they don't work right or, you know, you're starting to, oh, my God, I've got to take a call back or something's wrong, at that point you just fold your cards and say, look, we're going to wait for them to count the votes.
Yeah.
Because I don't trust my key precincts. I don't trust my exit polling now because if it was skewed enough to make me screw up the first time, then how do you know it didn't stay skewed? So you play it safe, and nobody did. Mm-hmm. I think they were, in the second case, I think they were spooked by the Fox network because Bush's cousin, John Ellis, came out and, you know, declared the whole election for Bush. And then all the networks didn't want to be left out, so they all, you know, kind of piled on and said, yeah, Bush wins, Bush wins, Bush wins. And then nobody apparently had read their own briefing books, which said when the vote is within a percent, there's an automatic recount, and in fact, nobody wins. And it was just, it was not their most golden moment.
So you would have held off.
I don't know. You know what?
Yeah.
It is real easy not to be involved in it and say, oh, I would have been perfect. But so I'm sure I wouldn't have been perfect. But I know that the second calls wouldn't have gotten made because it was just, it's kind of just like your, you know, it's a golden rule. If the numbers are questionable, yeah, wait for them to count the votes. It ain't no big deal to wait for the votes to be counted.
Well, the news business has become even more competitive than it was. Is that the driving factor in all this attempt?
Yeah, I think there's a frenetic competition sometimes, and it gets a little out of control. But there are, I will tell you, that out-of-control attitude does not usually exist amongst the anchors and the journalists in the network. That's a kind of a competition that exists amongst people, maybe even just at my level. Not that there's not an individual competition, but I promise you the people who make the calls and the anchors who have to sit there, as Tom Brokaw said, not with egg on their face, but omelet on their face, they would rather die than make a wrong call.
Yeah.
So they're not going to be moved by what other people are doing, but it was not a great moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, my question initially was, I guess, what do you think of television news? It seems that in recent years there is this hyper-competitiveness and also sort of a being driven by marketing aspect to news.
I think you put your finger on it. I think for me the greatest problem is not the competition,
yeah,
actually. For me the greatest problem is that there are consultants who kind of come in and say, look, you know, you got to give viewers what they want. You got to give listeners what they want. And what the consultants tend to do is tell you that what they want is softer news. What they want is more tabloid kind of news. What they want is kind of common, lowest common denominator kind of news. And, see, I think that's dead wrong. And that's probably a reason why the network audiences have continued to sink. And I think they're not doing their jobs when they fall prey to that. I was kind of lucky because I was never faced with having to do that when I did Nightline or World News Tonight, shows that shouldn't really be catering to purely viewer demands, because mm-hmm. They set an agenda in many ways. That wasn't an issue. I think too often consultants who, you know, it's interesting. You can read polls two different ways. I did in a journalism class yesterday. I asked, there were, I don't know, 20 students, and we said, all right, how many of you think that campaign finance reform is an important issue? Two-thirds of them said they didn't think it was. They didn't care about it. Mm-hmm. And one-third said they did. And I said, now, a pollster would look at that. A consultant would look at that and say, don't ever do pieces on campaign finance reform because two-thirds of the people don't care. I said, and you can read it that way, or what I would choose to read, since my journalistic sense is people need to know about campaign finance reform, I would read that that two-thirds of the people don't know enough yet to know that they should be interested. And so we then spent some time in the class talking about all the things that campaign finance reform will affect, mm-hmm. how it'll make your voice more powerful with your elected official because they're going to have to rely on you for a buck or two. The lobbyists are going to be diminished. And we went on and on and talked about those kinds of things. And, of course, it then turns out probably more than two-thirds of the class now was interested in campaign finance reform. So consultants sometimes when they walk in and say people don't care about this, what they're really reflecting and don't realize it is maybe people don't know enough about something yet to care or not care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the job of a journalist.
Well, we all talk about the consultants, and there's a lot of understanding among journalists how this works in local stations and elsewhere that the consultants do have this sort of marketing orientation. And that runs counter to the journalistic traditions. But is there such a disconnect between management and the producers, the people who make the editorial judgments, that we can't rein that in somehow?
Well, a lot of times, let's deal with it just at a local level for a moment. You know, I started at WBBM right up the road, and when I came there, the news director who had hired me was fired for low ratings shortly after. And the new guy who came in didn't want to – that was not a career path he was interested in following. Mm-hmm. And so consultants came in and started telling us, you know, the kinds of things we should do. And we, and then somebody came in from the network, because apparently all the CBS stations were having a problem. And so we put together what was a pilot for all the CBS-owned stations, at which there were seven at the time. Or actually, there were five at the time. And we did this extraordinary program. Now, in this program, we created little features. We had a feature about how when health departments close restaurants in your community, we would do a feature on each one of these dirty restaurants. And then we made a little logo that had a handsome rat sitting on top of a garbage can, threatening rat, actually. And that was a logo. Then we had a gossip columnist that they thought we should hire. And this gossip columnist would tell you what the beautiful people in town were doing. But we argued incessantly about, well, who is a beautiful person? So, you know, that was kind of going nowhere. But the most amazing thing was this consultant thought people love to see things. They like to see props. So that when the Chicago Stadium was ripped down, he made us bring a brick from the Chicago Stadium and hold it up on the set and say, this is all that's left of the historic Chicago Stadium. He thought they loved that. He told a reporter once to go back to a crime scene and grab one of the shell casings, even though it was evidence, right, because, you know, show this is one of the bullets that killed somebody. He had me once call the Navy. I actually did this. I'm so ashamed of this. He had me call the Navy during when we were covering military readiness, and he asked, and I had to ask them if they would loan me a Nike missile for the studio. They didn't. That's good. I mean, you know, I cringe at the thought. What would have happened if the John and Lorena Bobbitt story had occurred then? What prop would he have had me go out and get, you know, to help illustrate her move with the knife? At any event, it was they didn't do very well in the ratings after that anyways, but I went to the network. But consultants have enormous power because they claim they have the answers, and that means for certain suits, it's like, oh, this is the way to keep my job or get a bonus or even get rewarded, and that's compelling in any economy.
Now that the media world has both expanded and shrunk, the ownership is certainly in fewer hands.
Right.
I mean, do you see this as one of those things that sort of sets the trend? You know, are the consultants really at the helm of what happens in television news?
Well, no, I don't think they are completely. But I would also tell you that if I were sitting here and I was one of the mega merger bosses, I would sit there and say, how can you say that? In the past, it was ABC, CBS, and NBC. Mm-hmm. Three networks split about 98% of the audience.
True.
And now there's CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, there's Fox Cable News, there's MSNBC, there's CNBC. There's hundreds, maybe thousands of internet sites and stations and places. And if anything, the media has more sources now than ever before. That's what they would say. And there's some truth to that. Mm-hmm. But there's also an extraordinary integration going on, which is part of what I'll get into today. So I don't want to spend too much time on this. But there's a great vertical integration going on where you see companies, there may be more companies, but they own many, many, many more inputs. Mm-hmm. And so it has really kind of stifled a lot about what goes on. And the news media, everybody's become much more conservative. I don't mean conservative politically. Mm-hmm. I mean conservative in any risk they are willing to take, any story they are willing to cover. There's lots of stories they won't touch because they just, you know, they won't touch a story without a news peg for the most part because they don't want to take responsibility for bringing it, you know, for harping on something. Like you almost never see stories about race or labor, or it's tough to get environmental stories on. You just don't see that.
Well, you were at ABC at the time that ABC and Disney essentially completed their merger. And I can't help being curious if you saw some change in the attitude or the way that, you know, the news was conducted at ABC as a result of the change in ownership.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That merger was an interesting merger because it's penny ante almost compared to AOL Time Warner.
Amen.
It was a merger where, you know, the news divisions kept it and the television network kept its stuff together, mm-hmm. and Disney kept its 2 cents together. And it's also worth noting that Disney is not what it appears to be all the time. I mean, Disney is very much a real estate company, very much an investment company, and much less a communications company than people think. I mean, they may do The Lion King and make $300 million on Lion King, but they're going to sell 1.3 billion lions, you know, little stuffed toys.
Sure.
And there's a lot more money in the stuffed toys than in the movie. You could argue they make the movie to make the stuffed toy. Their parks make extraordinary amounts of money. This is a long-winded way of saying they weren't they really didn't come in and mess around with ABC News very much. I mean, Michael Eisner was really good about that. And now, of course, now you read stories that it has an impact on what they cover and how they cover. And, I know the journalists there, and I know Peter and Ted and the rest, and you're not going to be pushing those people around at all. So they keep their distance, I think.
Still, there is an argument, at least, that there is an economic incentive when you have a corporation owning the news shop that is so extensive and has so many holdings and so many interests.
Oh, absolutely.
That, you know, the news, you know, is maybe less bold.
Well, when it just comes to the financial requirements, mm-hmm. you have CEOs of major companies that are making promises to Wall Street about certain earnings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If they miss their earnings, I mean, I remember there was one company, it wasn't a media company, but missed its earnings by $2 million and lost $1 billion in market cap. You know, it would almost have been worth for the CEO to take $2 million out of his bank account and just throw it in the pot so they'd make their earnings estimate and they wouldn't get hammered on the street. When you start making promises and when those promises are bold about earnings, then you're going to take it out on every division of your company. That includes news. And before you assign a story that might put you over budget and therefore cost you your bonus, cost you incentive pay, you're going to probably hold back.
Our guest this morning is Rick Kaplan. He's a professor of journalism at Harvard University, former president of CNN USA, and he's also...
I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Illinois College of Communications.
Very good.
Nancy Casey would kill me if I didn't mention it at least once every 10 minutes.
We'll make sure to do that.
She's a great dean.
He's won numerous awards as a reporter, producer, has traveled the world, reported all over the place, and a great deal of experience in the news world, and that's what we're talking about this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. There's a bunch of things I could ask you. I guess there's one thing I wanted to really throw out. How has the media treated George W. Bush, do you think?
Well, in the beginning, they were so swept away by the really tawdry way that Clinton left office. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. People who were Clinton lovers were tremendously put out and angered by the way the president left office. And the president's and President Clinton's exit made so many headlines of its own. Mm-hmm. In the first month and a half, I think the estimate was, or the survey was, that stories about President Clinton and who he pardoned and why he pardoned and what family members benefited from the pardon and what furniture they walked out with and all the rest of that, it outnumbered stories about George Bush 10 to 1. Mm-hmm. And I think that helped President Bush. I think that was good because he had been cheated of a lot of time to get his cabinet together and he'd been cheated a lot of prep time, if you will. And so this kind of gave him a buffer. But it's, you know, who knows? There's a lot. He's being very aggressive about his tax cut. And I think he's starting to bring people on board. But, you know.
Well, this is, you mentioned the tax cut. We have a caller we'll get right to. But just a quick follow up on this. How has the media done in covering the tax cut and really helping people understand the total picture, what the tax cut would mean to average people like me who, you know, aren't in the upper income bracket and people in the upper income, and how would it affect the economy, how would it affect the budget, et cetera? Are we really getting to an understanding of that?
Well, you know, the problem that I see is that a lot of people on both sides, those who don't like the tax cut, frankly lie about who it's going to help and who it's not going to help and how unfair it is. And then those who support the tax cut, frankly, lie about who it'll benefit and who it won't. I mean, I've heard too many times too many officials at the highest levels of the government tell you that a majority of their tax cut is going to go to the lower income levels. Well, in fact, only 13% of the tax cut. Only 13% of the tax cut goes there. And that's not a majority. You know, that's not most of the money. And so there's a lot of – I think there's a lot of indecision about it and a lot of misinformation out there. I also think it's a very difficult issue to explain to people the difference between a $1.5 trillion or $2.3 trillion tax cut over 10 years. Remember, the last 2 years of his tax cut, he couldn't possibly be president anyways because it's 10 years, 9 and right. 10 years out. Right. And then, I mean, it's one of the toughest issues. I tend to think that one of the best things we could begin to do is, you know, we've just elected a president. Why not go along with him? Let him try what he wants to try. Give him a chance. If it doesn't work, then get him. You know, then fix it. But to me, it's like whoever gets elected, whichever party gets elected, the other party does whatever it can do to kind of stifle them mm-hmm. and prepare for the next election when maybe we can be in charge. That's just, it seems to me, counterproductive. It's almost like I yearn for a bit of a parliamentary system where at least give the guy a chance. Look, the guy got elected. Never mind all the, you know, the clouds around the election or who won or who got the most votes. Forgetting all that, George W. Bush is our president. This is what he wants to do. This is his key issues. Why not give him a chance to do it his way?
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's get on with them and mention the phone numbers. We're almost at our midpoint here with Rick Kaplan, former president of CNN US, a professor of journalism at Harvard University, and member of the faculty of the University of Illinois
College of Communications.
Yes, very good. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
My name is Chuck Vaughn. I'm kind of a political news junkie, and I applaud very heartily Mr. Kaplan's commentary regarding President Bush and letting him get, at least giving the guy a fair chance to get underway what he wants to get underway. I have a question.
Sure.
I'm very curious, and I'll hang up to listen. I respect Mr. Kaplan very much, but I'm an Imus in the morning fan. And I also hear always Don Imus take some real shots at Mr. Kaplan, and I wanted to call in for a fair balance, and if he wouldn't mind commenting on Don Imus's comments. Thank you, sir.
You know, actually, as hard as this is going to be for you to believe, Imus,
whoa.
Imus is an old friend, and what he does on his program, he does because his whole – and he says it constantly on his show. Their goal is to make people laugh. Their goal is to be funny. And he thinks that he makes people laugh and it's funny to talk about the big dumb doofus and to take shots at me, and that's fine. It's kind of like being the target of a Don Rickles attack. It's, I guess, my daughter used to actually get a lot of grief from some of her friends when she was in high school. You know, they'd say, oh, I heard Imus on the air and he's really killing your dad. And finally, my daughter turned to one of them and said, you know, it's funny. I don't hear Imus talking about your father at all. And, you know, it's something you live with. And you know, would I rather he not take shots at me? I'd like him to forget my name. And he's not about to do that for now. I guess he'll do that when he feels that there's no humor left in attacking me. And, you know, maybe I'll be an unhappier person because of it. So who knows?
Yeah, well, this strikes me as one of those conundrums where people get confused between show business
right.
and journalism.
Look, do you know who the second most popular president is in the 20th century? It's a quiz. You get extra credit for this.
So second who, most popular
second, who's the most popular?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
And who's the second most popular?
Probably FDR?
No. Hmm. You're going to hate this. You ready?
Okay.
Martin Sheen. And you sit there and go, do they know right. that West right. Wing is yeah. a fictional television show? Martin Sheen, in the latest set of polls, was the second most popular president mm-hmm. of the century. And, you know, it's terrifying to think that somebody thinks he's really a president. Although he does act in a wonderful way, doesn't he?
Well, actually, I rarely see the television programs of that kind. But
oh, nice. And you want to talk about it.
Well. At least
should we make comments about how you also have commercials on this show, on this commercial-free air?
You have a microphone. You
can say whatever you want. It's a First Amendment right.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Well, speaking of we were talking about some of the issues that are being covered, the media's treatment of George W. Bush. There's one other issue that I wanted to talk with you a bit about that you mentioned before, campaign finance reform.
Right.
And this, again, is one of those issues that may be somewhat complicated and difficult to explain to people, but at the same time, I think there is a suspicion among some people in the business and perhaps people who are simply news consumers, that the media don't do a good job covering it because they have a very large vested interest in campaign finance reform via political advertising and various other.
No, because most there are very few stations that are going on the air without their ads sold. I mean, especially at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, isn't it a nice little windfall? But it's hardly going to be an issue that's going to make the media all of a sudden oppose campaign finance reform. If there is no campaign finance reform, it'll be because those who are going to decide what the bill is are the ones who will be most affected by it, those people who are sitting. Mm-hmm. And an elected official being an incumbent and having a tremendous advantage in fundraising and everything else is more loath to change the system. Nobody really likes change anyways, but remember, all the lobby groups, I mean, if you want to talk about something that unites a lobby group, whether mm-hmm. it's the NRA or, I mean, the NRA will work arm in arm with lobby groups that wouldn't be caught dead in the same room with them under other circumstances, but they'll walk arm in arm together because if campaign finance reform, a good solid McCain-Feingold bill passes, it will really cut into their influence. And so they're all united in opposing it. A lot of congressmen and senators believe that, you know, they have a free walk almost to getting reelected if they keep their lobbies in line and mm-hmm. and things work out. But my God, if we get rid of this, if we get rid of the lobbies, then we're kind of at the mercy of our voters, and maybe that makes it more difficult. Well, I kind of like the idea of having my elected officials more accountable to me, and I like the idea about having we the people have much more meaning than it has right now. I don't like the special vested interest having their special influence in their special time.
But that's Rick Kaplan, the journalist.
But I think if you had the United, if you had as an item on the election ballot, being a camp, if the campaign finance mm-hmm. bill was right below, so you like Bush or do you like Gore?
Yeah.
And then the second thing you're going to vote on is not a senator or a governor. The second thing is, do you like this campaign finance bill or no campaign finance bill? I would have bet you that the American public would have voted big time to have a campaign finance bill.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's go to them. This is a listener in LaSalle County on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. My concern, my first question was going to be that where do people get their news? And I was thinking of I tend to try to be as aware as possible, but a lot of people I know, they work, by the time they get home, they could care less. And if you look at the ads in almost any news show, I mean, it's all geared to older people, basically. The cars that are very expensive, the laxatives, I don't even know. So my question was, number one, I wonder where they get their news. And then number two, in general, it doesn't make any difference. But if something like hoof and mouth disease or something came in the United States, who would they trust? So that was basically it. But before that, I must say your comment that Bush got cheated is hysterical because the exit polls were right. In Florida, more people thought they voted for Gore. And yet you have all of this, oh, Bush won, which is highly questionable, especially when you consider the roadblocks in black areas. You consider that there weren't enough ballots delivered to Democratic poll areas. So he was in Austin getting his new cabinet before he was even elected. So I disagree with you there. But the other thing, things like Clinton left himself vulnerable. But it wasn't until yesterday that I found out the 4 Hasidic Jews that he pardoned. They weren't pardoned. Their sentences were commuted. They have to stay in jail another year and give millions of dollars to the government. So I would not trust you if you started telling me about hoof and mouth disease. But where do you think the majority of people get their news?
Okay, that's a mouthful.
Yes.
First of all, I wouldn't begin to start telling you about hoof and mouth disease. But what I said, if I believe, is that I thought Bush got cheated out of a lot, out of some time to get.
Right, but he was in Austin putting his cabinet.
No, but it's one thing to put your cabinet together and have to do it quite secretly, because if the news media would have found him putting his cabinet together before the election, he would have been in a lot of trouble. And after he is still limited, and especially in that period where we were doing recounts and the rest. If he had, if it had been revealed that he was doing too much planning, too many phone calls. If you remember, he was not making a lot of phone calls. There were no leaks about who his potential cabinet might be, and since there were no leaks, you can rest assured that he wasn't making a whole lot of calls to people.
Well, so was Dan Burton. You know, when he had all the hearings on the pardons, which left the limelight off of Bush, do you think that was like a plot by the Democrats so that Bush couldn't get the...
Oh, by no means. And in fact, I would chide the news media that it's a lot more important to be covering the new president than to be sitting and watching Dan Burton do quite to do anything. I mean, I don't ever think there's much reason to watch Dan Burton do something. And I'm not really talking about the Hasidic commuting of sentences. I think the pardon that irked people was the Mark Rich pardon, and I think that the Mark Rich pardon is indefensible. And I understand, I think, lots of the reasons why President Clinton may have done that, and maybe we all would have done that if we were in President Clinton's shoes, but it's still a pardon. I don't love this that whole system of those quick pardons. There have been tremendous problems with it over the years. I mean, George Bush pardoned Caspar Weinberger, which, in a way, was even more heinous than any pardon handed out this time, because Caspar Weinberger would have had a stand trial and George Bush would have had to testify at it over Iran-Contra, and he pardoned him so there wouldn't be a trial. So it's not the first time there have been questionable pardons. I don't like the whole system
completely. Okay, so what about Cheney's chief of staff, who was Mark Rich's lawyer for 8 years and was at the Dan Burton thing, saying that, agreeing with selective prosecution, that Mark Rich should have been charged civilly, not criminally. Do you agree with that?
My personal opinion is that Mark Rich should have been charged civilly. But my personal opinion is also that it is not right when to have lived the life that Mark Rich has lived and run from indictment and run from a chance for to have his day in court, especially with the resources Mark Rich has. I think the way he chose to conduct himself when his life and his actions were under scrutiny, I think he did a disservice to himself and the country. I think that in doing business with the Ayatollah during the Iran hostage crisis, and doing the kinds of business deals that Mark Rich did, also kind of put a cloud over him. So if you're expecting me to say something nice about Mark Rich, you're going to be hanging on the phone a long time.
Yeah, that's true. But I think, you know, I think Clinton left himself vulnerable. But I think it's very dishonest that the news media, you know, like 3 weeks after the trashing the airplane, Bush says, oh, well, no, that didn't happen. 3 weeks later, Bush says it
No,
didn't
Bush
happen.
Actually said it the next day. I mean, he didn't say it 3 weeks later. When those stories came out, actually, Bush and a lot of his top people said, you know, that's just it's just not true. That didn't happen. And whether you heard about it or not, I remember hearing almost immediately that it didn't happen.
I think it was coached a little bit differently.
Look, I think I think Al Franken had the funniest thing to say about the pardons in general. He said that he really objected to all the criticism of Clinton for the pardons that he gave out. He said he really thinks the president ought to be complimented for all the people he didn't pardon, that he didn't pardon the Unabomber and Charles Manson is still in jail, and people ought to turn their attentions that way.
Okay, so obviously, if I saw...
You don't see the humor in that. Yeah. Now it's probably Al Franken's. Blame him.
Yeah. Considering that you and I disagree about how the news media handled so many things, if there's something really, really serious, and so there are all these people who went and voted for Gore, and they're told the Supreme Court says, oh, no, Bush is president, and they... You know, I don't know where they get their news.
No, well, you know, see, you're oversimplifying it. Look, believe me, you're, you know, we're not having a personal conversation, so I'm trying to be, you know, just kind of straightforward about it.
Well, I'm
not trying to tell you what I really think personally about something. I'm just trying to say, in terms of what is accurate and not accurate, if somebody votes and thinks they voted for Gore but didn't, you know what? That's too bad. the Democratic Party had a chance to challenge the setup of the ballots. The Democratic Party had all kinds of chances to change, and frankly, I would chide the Democratic Party officials who were stupid in Florida and made a ballot that was far too complicated. I don't like the idea of trying to guess at what somebody's intention might have been in voting because there is either a dimple or not. I will tell you, for the first time in my life, two and a half years ago, when I moved to Georgia to work at CNN, I had to use for the first time, one of these punch ballots. And the first time I went in and did it, I may not be the brightest light in the tree, but I'm not the dimmest either. And I screwed up my ballot. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. And, I got another ballot. And this last time it was very difficult. I mean, it's not an easy set of ballots to do. And the butterfly ballot in Florida is tough to follow. But with that said, you make a wrong vote, you make a wrong vote. Now, with that said, there were tens of thousands of ballots of African Americans that were screwed up, there were lots of people who were not given the chance to vote for wrong reasons, that they came to polling places and they were told, well, you're a felon and we're not going to give you a ballot, and that, of course, was wrong. Lots of people were disenfranchised that night. There are a lot of absentee ballots and a lot of mailed-in ballots that would have potentially gone for Bush that also were messed up. I think that Al Gore probably won the state of Florida. I think that for whatever the reason, I think when the final counts are all done, I think you'll see that Al Gore won the state of Florida. But George Bush is the president, and I want to move on. And I think Al Gore would say almost the same thing, I would hope. I mean, it's time to move on. It worked out maybe. And I don't buy the argument that he got more votes and therefore he should be president. I mean, we have an electoral system which I agree with, or you'd have a real tyranny of large states who, you know, it'd be like the whole campaign would be in eight states and everybody else can forget about it. So all I'm saying is, while I think Al Gore may have won, and while I think there were more mistakes there than I could count, I would hope what we would turn our attention to now is fixing the election system, because it was rather embarrassing to have it go the way it went. I would hope that states would fix the go from these strange little Chad ballots and maybe go either to machines, or I know there's a move to begin online voting, and people can argue about that, but I'm sure there are systems to make that work. Yeah. I would like to see our electoral system, the way people vote, I would like to see that reformed. You know, the problem is it's a very local issue, and you have a choice of buying new school buses or getting a couple of voting machines, and that's a no-brainer for most communities. We're going to do the school buses. Well, we learn on election night that maybe they should have gotten the voting machines. Maybe that the electoral system, the physical electoral system, should have been fixed, and maybe it will be. And I hope that you will listen to me talk about the news in the future.
We have just about 10 minutes left with Rick Kaplan. He's a former president of Cable News Network US. He's also he teaches journalism at Harvard University and also here at the University of Illinois College of Communications, and also here on the air on Focus 580. If you have any questions in the remaining time, we just have about 10 minutes left. The number to call around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Getting back to this issue of the caller raised about where people get their news. The last good research I saw on this is probably about a couple, 3 years old, by the Pew Center, I believe, showed that, according to their measure, 83% of Americans get most of what they know about the world from television news. Yesterday, I interviewed the head of resources for the future, Paul Portney, who indicated that their research shows that about 3 out of 4 of Americans is very confused and thinks that global warming is the same as atmospheric ozone depletion. This is one in a long list of things that people don't quite get. And I guess my question for you is, isn't that an indictment of television news?
Well, part of, you know, what I was saying was that first let's deal with where they get their news. Mm-hmm. While I think enormous percentage of people get their news from television, they now get their news from more than just three network programs. And I think that because the network programs are kind of softening their deliveries and softening their news, they're chasing some of the hard news core viewers away as well. And I think that's a real problem. I think a lot of people are going to the internet, which is Russian roulette, because there is so much misinformation on the internet, and there is so much inaccuracy on the internet, that if you talk to a lot of traditional news people, a lot of real solid journalists, they'll tell you that what they think is going to happen is you're going to get tired of getting wrong information, and eventually you'll come back to ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, that kind of a thing. And maybe that's the case, and we can hope for that. But if that is the case, then those networks are going to have to show that they are very serious towards core news viewing, meaning hard news viewing. I don't watch the evening news because I want to see a little mini magazine. I watch the evening news because I want to see the news. Also, it's a very important cultural experience for the country. It's one of those few moments where, whether you're a farmer in the Midwest or a businessman in the Northeast or a automobile worker in Detroit or a aerospace worker in Washington, I mean, no matter what part of the country you're in, we share this one experience. This is the evening news. This is the news of the day. And I think that's really important, but I think it's important if it's done traditionally and if it's done right. And I think the networks are going to have to move back towards traditional news, or people will continue their wandering in the desert, so to speak. I think it is an indictment that people don't know the difference between that, but I also think that you take a responsibility. You have a responsibility to yourself. And it's one thing to say that the media, hasn't done it, but the truth is every network could show you hours and hours of documentaries, including PBS, especially PBS, about the difference between global warming, shows about the ozone and the rest. And you know what? You can go to the internet. You can go to a book. You can read it in newspapers. You can read it in magazines. If you don't know the difference, fie on you. You have a responsibility. You can't spend your life being so incredibly passive. Look, 50% of the American public who could vote didn't. And more horribly and more terrifying, 70% of the kids who are of college age and just above didn't vote. 70%. And yet the issues that were on the table in this election, what's going to be the course of the Supreme Court for the next 25 years? It clearly was a clear choice between two candidates in terms of their abilities and their stands. And if these young people are going to have to live with the results of the Supreme Court, are going to have to live with what kind of a tax cut, are going to have to live with all of those kinds of issues, if 70% of them didn't think it was important enough to vote, you know what? That's their problem. That's not the media's problem. There's a limit to what the media is responsible for.
We have a couple calls waiting in just about 5 minutes left. We'll try to get them both in. We'll go next to a listener on a car phone on line number 4.
Oh, good.
Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have some concerns about one of the comments you made with regards to President Bush's tax cut, that we should just consider the fact that he was elected and now let him have it. And I'm a Democrat, and I have some really philosophical differences with this tax cut and the people that it's going to help and the people that it's not going to help that much. And I don't think we should just let them have it. I think that this is what the Democrats have been doing for the last 3 months. I think we have to stand up to these things, and we have to fight for the things that we believe in.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I want to be clearly understood on this. I don't particularly think that the president's tax cut as proposed is good either. I think that it helps too many of the people who don't need the help, and it doesn't help enough of the people who do. My issue is maybe deeper and more philosophical. I think too much time is spent in this Congress and the last Congress and the one before that, that once we got rid of all the smoke-filled rooms, which we thought was such a good idea, and maybe it was a good idea, but once we got rid of that, once we got rid of the ability of these parties to work in a bipartisan way, it seems, over anything, all of a sudden, whether Bush is the popularly elected president or not, the fact is I would like to see the president of the United States, no matter what party he's from or she's from, I'd like to see the president do great. Because if the president does great, we do great. And I just think too much time is spent trying to just screw the guy in office.
Oh, I'm not saying that, and
I'm not saying to give him a blank check either. But you know what it's kind of like.
All right, like that's what you said.
Let
him have what he wants on that.
Well, here's the point, though. This is not a This is not a two trillion dollar tax cut this year. This is across 10 years. I promise you, if he sets out on a course, and in the first year, it's starting to go south, or the second year it's starting to go south, Congress can rear up and say, you know what, you don't know what you're doing, and can turn around, and then we'll probably get a majority to change course. But we never let a guy get started. Do you know what I mean? We just don't let someone.
That's possible, too. But at the same time, how about the people that get hurt along the way? I think that there are some serious issues here.
But you know what? No one's going to get.
The people who aren't going to. Benefit from
but wait a second. Nobody gets hurt along the way. In the first year, you don't get hurt. You may not get as much money as you ought to get, but you don't get hurt. You're going to get more money. You're going to get some tax return. You're going to get some tax rebate. The fact is, if it turns out that it's really unfair and it's not doing what it set out to do, then we can change it. But no one gets hurt in the first year. And you're not going to just let it sit there for 10 years so that you eat up the surplus or you destroy the economy. I would just like to see presidents get a chance, no matter what party they're from. I would like to see presidents get a chance to try to do what they set out to do. But if everything is a compromise, then your government looks like a camel, and that's not the most handsome animal. No offense to camels.
Hope the caller will forgive me. We have about 2 minutes left. I want to squeeze in one last caller, listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
I haven't heard the whole show, but I did want to comment on the travesty of the election of the president. I was listening to Dan Rather that evening, and now this morning I understand that he may be leaving because of poor ratings. And this,
Dan Rather?
Therein lies the whole problem. When I turn on the news, I want to hear the news. I don't want to turn it on and hear a news preview 10 minutes or half an hour before.
Well, I agree with you. I don't know that Dan Rather is retiring. I've not heard that story myself, but I think you're right.
Well, I'm sorry to cut the caller off, but we really just have about a minute left, and there's much more we could talk about. But we want to make sure also to mention that Rick Kaplan is in town to teach classes at the University of Illinois College of Journalism, part of the College of Communications faculty, and we'll be giving a brown bag lecture today at noon, room...
Yeah, but it's room 213, but I have to tell you, it's real limited space, and it's open to students and faculty, and if some of your, if a bunch of your viewers decided, well, why don't we go there in person and throw something at them, it may overcrowd the room.
Well, that would be a supply and demand problem.
That's exactly
right.
That would be the university's trouble.
That's right. Rick Kaplan has been our guest. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's really my pleasure. You know, every time I come here to the school, I always come here to the show. So
I know.
See you again.
And we appreciate that very much.
It's my pleasure.
We'll see you in the future.
You bet.